So today's topic is electromagnetism and quantization of the free electromagnetic field. However, before we do that, I just want to go over a few things from yesterday's lecture. I understand that yesterday's lecture was extremely rushed, and some of you are unsatisfied with it. So let me, some of it, you know, there's a long detailed calculation that you know, you should do by yourself. There is really nothing mysterious about it. But some of the other conceptual points, I think, were glossed over, which I should come back to. And one of them was that the anticommutator for two spinner fields vanish when the points are space-like separated. However, in my notes, instead of a bar, I wrote a dagger here. So let's put a B here. And those two expressions are the same. They actually, so this is 0 for space-like separated. But these two guys actually imply one another. And that's because psi bar is nothing by psi dagger of gamma 0. So if you take the A element of this guy, what you're doing is you're saying C, C, A. This is a matrix multiplication. So from this equation, you can just factor out a gamma 0 from the psi bar. And if this is true, this is also true. So it's not obvious this motivated our definition of the Feynman propagator. But before that, I actually gave you an explicit expression for the anticommutator when for x and y, which are not necessarily space-like separated. So the expression I gave you was a distribution type of expression. So in general, where the D function essentially involves a delta function, and I told you that from the form of this D function, you can see that this thing vanishes when x and y are space-like separated.
Where do the indices
go? Oh, sorry, yeah. So this is a matrix, so we are looking at the AB indices of this operator. And to do this, what you need to do is to say, go to a reference frame where if x and y are space-like separated, where x naught is equal to y naught, then you can show that this second term actually cancels the first term in that case. The thing that naturally occurs in the Dyson formula is the Feynman propagator. And I define this to be the expectation value of, so this is the AB element, and it has arguments x minus y. The expectation value of x, of psi a at x and psi bar b of y vacuum expectation value if x naught is greater than y naught, and minus of psi bar of a, and this is actually not obvious why this is actually is necessary for this to be Lorentz invariant. If y naught is greater than. So this thing is written as the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of psi a of x, sorry, psi a, psi and psi bar of y. And, you know, Mary Jean pointed out what was the square bracket was for. I'm writing it again. And the idea is that you take the a, b element of this, and this is the definition of the time ordering. Okay? Now, it's not because of the indices, it's not obvious why this is the correct thing to do, but you can explicitly check that, you know, this definition does lead you to something that is Lorentz invariant. So to do this, what you do is that you take your expressions for psi and psi bar, you know this very explicitly, and you can compute this thing and you can compute this thing just using the commutation relationships, okay? Nothing mysterious there. And what you find is that when x naught is greater than y naught, you find that the Feynman propagator for fermions is given by a three-dimensional integral but whose measure is Lorentz invariant, and therefore this part is Lorentz invariant. An operator, P slash, plus M, whose AB element we take, and e to the power minus P dot x minus y. So this thing is Lorentz invariant. However, you can actually write it in a more explicit Lorentz invariant form, where you know where your momentum is no longer on mass on shell, your particle is no longer on shell. So the p0 component of your momentum is now, you know, it's not determined by the three momentum part, and you have a 2π4 here. And p slash plus m divided by p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon e to the power minus I p dot x minus y. Where now this I epsilon bit just tells you how to do the p0 contour integral. Okay.
So when we trace out the spin degrees of freedom, it is out in the p slash plus m.
Right, sorry. Yeah. So I should have a b here. Okay. So now I can ask, okay, what happens when x naught is less than y naught? Then the definition, which now involves psi bar first and psi second. So if you work this out, it gives you the minus of d cubed p So let's be careful about our, which looks Lorentz invariant because, okay, I missed a 2 of EP here. But this expression looks very different from this expression here, the first line. But we can, again, go off shell and find an expression for this guy, and we get the same expression as before. However, since now x0 is less than y0, for this expression to make sense, the integral, the contour you have to choose, which is specified by this guy, is different. So let's just draw the contours for the two cases. For the case where x0 is greater than y0, the pole of our integrand is at minus EP and plus EP. And the contour that we choose is you go along the real axis, you go below this pole, and you get above this other guy, and you have to close the contour in the upper half plane. If you don't do that, the P0 integral in this expression does not converge. And when you do that, you use the Cauchy's residue theorem to show that this actually leads to that. And when x0 is less than y0, you have the same expression, but now the rules of contour integrals tell you that you have to close in the lower half plane. So which picks out the residue from this pole, and therefore you get a different expression. So this proves, because you get the same expression here and there. Oh, I missed some i's, I over there. Okay. So this proves that the expression for the Feynman propagator is indeed, Lorentz invariant. Okay, before I move on to electromagnetic field, let me just come back, and I misspoke at some point and correct that. I said that the proper orthochronous Lorentz transformations must satisfy this. That's actually not correct. It has to be this. And thanks, Lely, for pointing this out. And you know this because if you make a boost along the x direction, your boost matrices look like this. Right? And the cosh, when in the limit where there is no boost, this thing goes to 1. Cosh is bounded below by 1. So just a correction there. Okay, anything else stemming from the last lecture before I move on to the electromagnetism? Oh, sorry. Okay, let me see if I wrote something. Oh, yeah, you're right. What I say and what I write are two different things. You're right. So for x0 less than y0, there's a minus sign here. You're right here.
The p slash minus m is correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So this detail is actually given in the notes, so you can actually see if that's correct. Okay. Right. So, yeah, that's another thing I wanted to mention before I, you know, move on, is, you know, there's a similar LZ formula for, you know, fermions, you know, which is similar to bosons. And, you know, one of the things that Dan probably mentioned in one of his, he did mention in his lectures, but, you know, because there was so much detail, this didn't kind of, it wasn't emphasized, and which was implicitly used in yesterday's lecture, and which I put as a footnote in the tutorial. But the idea is, you know, the LZ implies that if you take a matrix element in the interacting theory, where you have, say, two outgoing particle, and compute the transfer matrix, where K1 and K2 are a two-particle state with incoming momentum. So this is, and they can also have spin labels, S1, S2, R1, R2. Then this is a formula that Peskin explicitly writes down. And so this is given by time t going to 1 minus I epsilon of this matrix element of the free theory, where 0 denotes the states in the free theory. So this is P1, P2. S1, S2, and there is a time-ordered exponential where this T is this T, of the interaction Hamiltonian, but now written in terms of operators in the free theory, where we only take those diagrams which are connected and because they have to be connected, because otherwise it would not be the transfer matrix. The S matrix has the unconnected diagrams, or and you only compute the amputated. So which means that, you know, all the loops that you have that from, you know, in the external legs, you know, those things have been amputated. The zero means that those are of states in the free theory. Okay. So everything over here is stuff in the free theory, but that's, you know, so this was assumed. Okay, now let's, yeah?
What does the limit mean here?
The limit is when you take you take the time. So, you know, like our system evolves from minus infinity to plus infinity in time. So that's basically the limit we are taking, but we are inserting a little imaginary part so that So in the case of the, when Dan showed how the interacting vacuum was related to the free vacuum, you know, you actually had to take this limit when in the computation you had some point, some exponential factor with some energies of the different energy eigenstates. And if you don't take the time to have a little imaginary part, then all these different states actually, all the, all the states which are different from the vacuum also would also contribute. So to relate the interacting theory with the free theory, you have to actually insert a little bit of an imaginary part when you're taking your time to infinity, right? And this is a formal thing which, you know, allows you to relate the two different theories. It's not clear to me what physically it means. Yes?
I would say just like cooling off the system in a way.
Cooling off of a system. So what you're saying is that there's a statistical mechanical interpretation to this.
The imaginary component of time gives you basically the idea that you're taking the limit at zero temperature.
Ah, okay, right. So. So you're saying that, okay, so what Martinez is saying is that you're basically, you know, this is, so there is some statistical mechanical version of this formula. And in that formula, you're basically, you know, inserting this amounts to projecting down to the zero temperature limit of the theory, right? Something like this. So you know, like, in the context of quantum field theory, you should probably just think of this as some formal, limit that you take, which allows you to connect the interacting theory matrix elements to the free theory matrix elements. Right? I mean, at some point, Dan showed you how this guy was related to this guy, right? And in showing that, he actually used this thing as well. So, sorry? Okay, so our next topic is electromagnetism. So we start with some classical considerations. So So we all know the Maxwell's equations. So this is Faraday's law. And then we have Ampere's law, Gauss's law, and the absence of magnetic monopoles, right? So Maxwell's equations were famous because they led Einstein to formulate the special theory of relativity. So the symmetries of Maxwell's equations are not the symmetries of your Newtonian theory. And Einstein discarded the symmetries, the Galilean symmetry of Newtonian mechanics for and opted for the symmetry of Maxwell's equation. So these equations admit, you know, plane wave electromagnetic solutions, and they're Lorentz covariant, and you are and the fact that the E field and the B field, so the E field and the B field, they are three-dimensional vectors. They go on to form a rank 2 antisymmetric tensor in 4 dimension. And there was the physical motivation for this. You did a tutorial during a relativity course, probably the first tutorial. So we want to write Maxwell's equation in a form where the Lorentz covariance is manifest, right? Because if they're relativistic, they're Lorentz covariant, why write them in this form where the Lorentz covariant is not manifest? So to do this, you know, we introduce a rank 2 tensor. So these are the tensor indices. And because it's rank 2, I can write it as a 4x4 matrix. So this is an antisymmetric 4x, you know, rank 2 antisymmetric tensor. So the F0i components are the electric field, and the Fij components are the magnetic fields. So to complete the to actually express the Maxwell's equation in covariant form, we also need to covariantize the sources. So we introduce a 4-dimensional vector, which is called the 4-current. And the zeroth component of this, we call it the charge density. And the 3-dimensional component is the current, right? So if you do this, then the two of those Maxwell's equations, which have sources, so the equation with sources those equations become this. And because f mu nu is antisymmetric, you can always contract this with a derivative with respect to x nu. But derivatives, you know, commute. So this object is this, you know, second derivative operator is symmetric in mu and nu, whereas this is antisymmetric. So that means the left-hand side of this equation of this is when you apply with the derivative operator and contract it, gives you zero. So this implies that the four-dimensional divergence of the right-hand side must be zero. In other words, the source that you couple to your Maxwell field must be conserved. The charge must be conserved. So this kind of, you know, hints at what kind of matter we should couple, you know, to Maxwell's equation. So there, the other two equations. Yeah. Oh, so there's probably a plus sign there. Let's see. So, okay. So, okay. One, you put I equals to one, j equals to two, right?
Yeah.
So that means your first row, second column. So this is the zeroth row.
Yeah.
This is the first row, and second column. That's B, right? So yeah. Okay, so so the Maxwell's equation without sources that turns out to be this combination. So if you take the derivative of f, no contraction, and cyclically permute the indices, they have to be zero. Because f mu nu is antisymmetric, because this is true, this equation is actually is derived from, can be derived from this thing. You can show that this actually leads to this, where the square brackets are the antisymmetrization. Okay? And those of you who know differential forms, this equation is saying that f has to be closed. So you know from your classical electrodynamics course that the Maxwell field has two independent polarization. Therefore, it has two independent degrees of freedom. So if you take those to be the transverse component of the electric field, the magnetic fields are actually determined. They are not independent. Okay. So you have two independent polarizations. So there's an alternative formulation of the theory, which was discovered before the advent of quantum mechanics. So this, we can introduce a four-dimensional vector called the four-vector potential. And you can define the relationship between this four-vector potential and the Maxwell field strength. To be of this form. Okay. So at the face of it, you know, we are introducing two new redundant degrees of freedom because A mu has four independent components. We'll see that this is related to the fact that your theory now has some redundancy in its description. So then the Maxwell's equation with sources that becomes the D'Alembertian acting on so this is where the box is this thing. It is the four-dimensional version of the Laplacian operator, also known as the D'Alembertian operator. But the way that we have defined a nu implies that this equation is automatically satisfied, that this equation for if you substitute the expression for f mu nu in terms of A, this becomes an identity. And that is more obviously seen from this expression because there's a derivative over here and there's a derivative in the expression for f mu nu. And you know that derivative operators commute, but that equation has all its indices anti-symmetrized. So those two facts together mean that, you know, that equation is an identity. So, okay. So how should, yeah, so this thing so classically, you know, there is, you don't really gain anything by introducing a mu other than a different point of view, right? So classically, a mu is a kind of luxury. However, quantum mechanically, it turns out it's a necessity. A mu essential for quantum theory. As the name suggests, it's a potential. So you'd think that, you know, we don't actually ever observe potentials. We observe some kind of field strength that is derived from the potential. But and that's true in general in most of the cases over here, but there are some physical, you know, situations where certain aspects of A mu play a role. Certain topological aspects of A mu play a role. And I won't go into the detail of this, but I want you probably have seen at some point the Aharonov-Bohm effect. So this is our motivation, one of the motivation for saying that A mu actually is physically relevant. So the Aronov Bohm effect. So what it one of its formulation is that you have some source of electrons, some kind of, you know, and you have a double slit in front. So this is a double slit. And here you have some screen. And there's some interference pattern coming from the fact that your electron source is a coherent source, and therefore you have some, you know, interference. But now if you introduce a solenoid behind the screen, so this is a solenoid, and if you run a current through the solenoid, then there'll be a magnetic flux going through the solenoid. And the magnetic flux, you know, if the solenoid is small enough, it actually, the magnetic field falls off very quickly outside. So outside, you know, if the solenoid is long, you know, the outside there is no magnetic field. It's really, you know, just going through. You know, the magnetic field strength outside is extremely weak. So B is, you know, zero here, whereas inside B is not zero. However, if you now work out what the A or the gauge potential is, it, you know, it's non-zero outside. Now you can work that out. And then you see that, you know, the interference pattern you get here is actually shifted relative to the case where there is no current through here. And that shift is given by the total number of flux that goes through the solenoid. So the only way that could happen is because if the electron wave function actually couples to the non-zero vector potential field outside. And so this is one, you know, example where the fact that you have a gauge field has some, you know, measurable effect. The whole effect is a lot more subtle because you don't actually, you measure some kind of twist in the gauge field rather than the twist in the gauge field is actually given by the number of fluxes which go through here. And the whole argument, you know, result follows from the single valuedness of the electron wave function.
Right,
you cannot.
Itself doesn't really matter outside because it can always shift it because the Maxwell equations are already affected. I mean, that doesn't shift to anything, right?
No, you don't. You cannot choose A mu to be zero outside. Okay. That's, you know, there is no way you can choose a vanishing A mu that will actually give you the B field that is non-zero inside. So, you know, the B field, you know, as we shall see that there is an ambiguity in describing the A field. Two A fields will be related by gauge transformation, but you cannot send it to zero. And also, when you actually quantize the theory, it turns out that you have to quantize in terms of A mu. So we want to quantize the theory, so we want to get some kind of a Hamiltonian. And so we probably want, at some point, to go to the Hamiltonian, we first want to write down some Lagrangian. So we can ask, what kind of Lagrangian gives us this classical equation? Now, we only want that equation because the other equation, because we have formulated in terms of A, the other equation is an identity. So you can show that, it's very easy to show, that this Lagrangian, and if you plug this into the Euler-Lagrange equation, where there is now a sum over rho, you actually get this thing. So now I'm considering the case where the sources are set to zero. Okay? And I highly recommend you to do this computation if you're unfamiliar with doing calculations involving indices. So you express this in terms of A mu and A nu, and then plug this into here and show that, you know, this actually does follow. It's a good practice. However, this Lagrangian has an interesting property. Because this is antisymmetric in F mu nu, in mu nu, there are no terms that involve the derivative of zero. And that's because if you look at F, F0, 0 is 0, right? Because it's antisymmetric. So the Lagrangian does not contain any A0. So A0 is not a physical degree of freedom, it would appear. A0 is a Lagrange multiplier. So, you know, it's that means that its equation of motion, if you calculate what the equation of motion for A0 is, it's a non-dynamical equation for A. But it does impose a constraint, and that constraint is, so the equation of motion for A0 is this object. So this relates, in principle, A0 with the three-vector A.
Where are the equation came from? Is that source-free equation?
So I'm not, you know, if I wanted sources, I would have added a source term. I'm now considering the Maxwell's Lagrangian without source.
Is it from the,
Oh, you mean this thing?
That one.
No, this is actually the equation of motion for A0 coming from this Lagrangian. Okay. So suppose that, you know, in cases where, you know, if the three vector A is, you know, this is, in this case, when the second term vanishes, you know, this means that this gives you Gauss's law without sources. So Gauss's law in this formulation is a constraint. So we see that we have, you know, three apparent physical degrees of freedom. We still have one more than we would like, because we know that in electromagnetism, classically, we have only 2 degrees of freedom, which are the polarization. And this is basically related to the fact that our theory has this quote-unquote symmetry. So if you take the gauge potential and replace it, sorry, the four-vector potential, and replace it by this object, then the F mu nu that's created out of this thing does not change. Again, this uses, sorry, this uses the, so the fact that our definition of F mu nu is antisymmetric in mu and nu, whereas two derivatives are actually commuting. Okay. So this extra term has no effect on F. So this is known as a gauge transformation. And hence, a mu is called a gauge potential. And this symmetry within quotes is called the gauge symmetry. This, I put the word symmetry within quotations, and that's because this is actually not a symmetry, but it's a redundancy of your description of the system. So note that both A and A tilde, sorry, A prime, they give you the same F, and it's really physically, you know, apart from this Bohm-Aronoff twist thing, you know, even physically, this is what we measure, the Fs. And the F is not changed. And you can say, okay, what about Noether's theorem? Can we get a charge out of this? And the answer is no. And because if you go back and think about Noether's theorem, the symmetries that we consider there are space-time independent symmetries. The parameter of transformation there do not depend on space-time points. Here, the parameter is a function of space-time. So Noether's theorem breaks down. You cannot use Noether's theorem in this case. If you make this into a global transformation, so make alpha to be constant, of course, this term vanishes, and you don't have the gauge transformation anymore. Okay, so... Sorry?
If we consider the constant shift of the, like forget about the gauge transformation, we do a constant shift of the AU.
Right.
Isn't that still absolutely?
Right. So if you're just adding stuff to your A, and then your because F mu nu is right, yeah, that, yeah, that's, so you can do that, but the problem that is that you if you that won't be a Lorentz covariant transformation, because your constant would have to be a four-dimensional, it'll have four components, right? And that's not something that's going to transform, covariantly under, that would break your Lorentz covariance. So the gauge symmetry is not a symmetry, but a redundancy of description. And this freedom allows us to impose certain conditions on our gauge potential. So, for example, we can impose various conditions on the divergence, the three-dimensional divergence of A. We can impose, for example, this condition. And this is this choice of condition on A is called the Coulomb gauge. So imposing this condition on the Coulomb gauge, you know, reduces our degree of freedom from 3 to 2. Okay. So the gauge symmetry allows us to actually, you know, reduce down to the number of degrees of freedom. There is still some redundancy in description. And because if you can always add to A some curl, a three-dimensional curl of some vector, and this will not change this condition, right? So the Coulomb gauge, you know, this choice of condition that we impose on A is manifestly not, it is not covariant. So you can try to quantize the theory in the Coulomb gauge, but we won't do that. We'll do that in a different gauge called the Lorentz gauge. So this is one of the conditions that you can impose on your gauge field. And this choice is known as the Coulomb gauge. And there's still some gauge freedom left. Because if you add to your three-vector potential something like this, then that will still respect the Coulomb gauge. And we'll see that this, whatever gauge choice we make, this sort of ambiguity, there's still some wiggle room. So the quantization procedure that we are going to take is the Lorentz covariant, Lorentz invariant quantization procedure. So we want to impose some Lorentz invariant choice of gauge. So so the Lorentz invariant gauge choice. There are many such gauge choices. The simplest one is to take the four divergence of A to 0. And this is known as the Lorentz gauge. And this is actually a different Lorentz. Again, like the Coulomb gauge, the Lorentz gauge does not fix the gauge completely, because if you now replace your A mu by this transformation where chi solves is a solution to the Laplace to this equation, then this choice is not affected by this sort of transformation as far as chi is the solution satisfy this equation. So how do we think of these sort of, you know, gauge freedom? There's a very nice geometrical picture you can formulate. And this geometrical picture becomes very important when you're trying to quantize the theory in terms of path integrals. So in Francois's course, you will see how this geometrical picture plays an important role. Yes?
So I'm just wondering if the vector field becomes massive, does the Coulomb gauge and the Lorentz gauge condition change?
So when the vector field becomes massive, then your gauge symmetry is broken.
Yeah, but we still have some residual symmetry.
Yeah, I think you do. I'm not sure exactly what those symmetries are. There's this field, you know, that's a different kind of field theory called the Proca field. I'm not exactly sure what the symmetries of those theories are.
So I'm just wondering if we have two conditions here in the massive vector field, we only have one condition.
Right. For the massive case, you know, you'd have only because you'll expect 3 degrees of freedom, so you will basically have you'd have
the first argument remains untouched, the one that you brought with the
First argument, you know,
because I mean, still, I mean, you can have squared, but that still doesn't give any
tangent, but the condition, precise condition is actually changed because
yes.
Now you have a mass term. So the precise condition will change. So I'm not exactly sure. So, you know, this gauge transformation is no longer a symmetry of that Lagrangian. Whether there is a residual symmetry, I'm not sure. You know, in the case that we're interested in, which is to try to describe photons, you know, that's something that you don't want your field to have mass, because we know that the photon is massless. So that's why we look at the, you know, at the gauge case with the gauge symmetry.
But in weak force, we can have some massive
factor. Right. So for the weak, so there's a generalization of this for non-abelian gauge theories. And that's applied to the weak interaction. And we know that in the weak interaction, the force-carrying particles are massive. And therefore, you know, there is a conflict between the mass of those gauge bosons and the gauge symmetry. So there, the symmetry is actually still there, but it is not manifest. And that's exactly what the you introduce an extra field called a Higgs field, which has 4 components. And what happens is that 3 of those 4 components, they become the massive part of 3 of the vector bosons, which were massless. So they look as if that they are massive, you know, they acquire mass by kind of stealing or eating components of the Higgs field. So there, you know, it's a very subtle procedure to give masses to gauge bosons. Okay.
I just looked it up on Wikipedia, and it says that the Stickelberg, I mean, this is related to a gauge fixed version of the Stickelberg action.
Right.
The Stickelberg is a scalar plus a massive spin one.
Right, but so you need to introduce the scalar field if you want the Stickelberg symmetry.
But it would be fine here because we would have 4 true degrees of freedom. We would have 3 from the massive spin 1 and 1 from the scalar, so that there's no need to kill 1 more degree of freedom.
Right, so you mean that, so your statement is, but you know, you still have to introduce the Stickelberg field if you want the massive case to have this extra symmetry.
But I'm just saying that there doesn't have to be only 3 propagating degrees of freedom. Doesn't
right,
have
right.
Spin one. There is still the scalar field that is still there.
Right.
So maybe this one just doesn't have any symmetries.
Okay.
So it could be that there is still the scalar field hiding somewhere.
Right. Okay, well, we are not discussing the Stickelberg and the Proca field here, so let's. But I just want to kind of tell you that the gauge symmetry is always in conflict with masses of the vector boson. And in the standard model, this is a problem which was solved by Higgs. And that's why he got the Nobel Prize for it.
So if he asks you to get symmetry, we have to ask you to get symmetry.
You still have the SU2 gauge symmetry. It's not obvious. It's spontaneously broken. Some people say spontaneously hidden. So it's still there, but it's not, you know, it's not manifest.
The like as Yan pointed out, in case of even with the mass, the first argument is intact, right? So one degree of freedom goes away not because of the
right. Yeah, but what I wanted to say is that that particular, you know, constraint equation you get is changed though. Okay, so there's a very nice geometrical picture. And the picture is that, you know, how do you interpret this gauge degree of freedom? So suppose you consider the space of all solutions of, say, the free Maxwell's equation. So this is the space of solutions and then what happens is that you have, you know, some, you know, solution, but if you make a gauge transformation, you move in that space of solutions. But every point on this surface is physically equivalent. So this is called a gauge orbit. And they're all physically equivalent. And now if you choose another, a different physical configuration, so physically it's distinct, then under gauge transformation, it'll give you a different orbit. So the space of solution is foliated by these gauge orbits. And the meaning of the gauge fixing condition is that you're choosing a slice through this space and you're picking out one point from each gauge orbit. So this is a gauge fixing condition. Different gauge fixing condition amounts to, you know, picking another different slice. So gauge fixing, this is also gauge fixing. And the fact that even after gauge fixing, there is some residual, you know, gauge freedom left means that there is still some wiggle room over here. Yes?
You said this is space of solutions. Like, what did like the points on here actually correspond to?
Sorry?
What do like the points on here actually correspond to?
What does the point?
What are the points on here?
Right. So so if you take a random point, you know, this gives you an A mu. You know, this is all the possible AMUs which solve Maxwell's equation.
Is different orange line represent the different solution for different J? Or is it all free solution? Free solution has
so
to
I, be. Yeah, so if you fix your J, that would, you know, so you're taking sources. I'm not taking sources here, but if you do take sources, then
they just have different spaces.
Right. So, you know, so suppose you have, say, in the say absence of sources, we can have physically distinct solutions to Maxwell's equations, right?
How is it possible? I mean, in vacuum, like we...
Well, you know, you think of some, you know, some electromagnetic field propagating through the vacuum. It could be a plane wave, right? Or it could be a spherical wave. And, you know, it could be... So the thing is that, you know, if you determine all your boundary conditions such that, you know, the solution to your equation is unique, then of course, you know, we are just projecting down to just one slice. But if you don't, then, you know, we actually have all these different slices.
Okay, so this is the solution for each different boundary condition.
Right, yeah. So let's now move on to the quantization. So, you know, we would like to impose something like this. But we'll show that this is not possible to do in the quantum theory as an operator equation. That this as an operator equation leads to contradictions. So before quantizing, you know, if we go back to what our Maxwell's equation looked like in terms of A, and in the absence of sources, then our Maxwell's equation is simply this. So this should, you know, ring a bell. This looks like the, you know, Klein-Gordon equation without masses for four scalar fields. So we can write down the classical solution to this equation readily. This will be given by some sum over free, you know, plane waves. So we do a Fourier decomposition just by analogy with the classical Klein-Gordon equation. But there are four independent solutions, so I can have, just as in the case of spinner, we had four independent spinners in our complex scalar field, complex spinner field. Here, A mu is not complex, it's real. That's something we know from you know, classical electromagnetism. That this, since this has four independent degrees of freedom, we can introduce four polarizations. So I'm writing the mu component, you know, this as a polarization vector. I'm calling them polarization. So they are the four vector part of the four vector counterpart of the. Of the spinners that we saw in the case of Dirac field. And then we have some, you know, creation operator, well, Fourier coefficient, which will become creation operators on quantization. And because this is real, the polarization vector here must be the complex conjugate of this, and over here this must be the complex conjugate of this. So for this lecture, I will take these polarization vectors, epsilon, to be real. But if you want to consider circularly polarized waves, things like that, then you'll have to take them to be complex. So we have four of these guys where lambda so these are the polarization vectors. So we are still doing classical stuff. So from our gauge fixing condition, if we now insert this expression of A in our gauge fixing condition, then we get a constraint on our polarization vectors. And the constraint we get is this, the contraction of the polarization vector with the four momentum of the wave must be zero. So we expect two of the polarization vectors to be of this form from physical grounds. The zeroth component is zero, and the three component is, say, some three vector E of one, such that E of one, its dot product with the three-dimensional part of P is zero. This is what it means for a transverse polarization. Or we can have this but this so these guys will satisfy this condition, but this condition is more general, has more general solutions. For example, you can take a polarization vector which is say proportional to the four momentum of your plane wave. But because p squares to zero, because this is zero, and that follows from just our Maxwell's equation. Because that just follows by if you just plug that into our Maxwell's equation, this implies that okay, let's put a proportionality sign, that a polarization vector of this form will also solve this equation. Okay. Yeah?
Why are we considering only when lambda equal 1 and 2?
No, I'm saying that these are two of these solutions. There are other solutions as well. But for example, there is a solution. I'll actually write down the basis for all the four solutions. So I'll write down some examples. So these polarization vectors, we impose the following completeness relationship on them. So they have to satisfy some completeness relation. just keep things general for now. So we have a prime here. So the completeness relationship have to be covariant, and they have some orthogonality relationship, which is you take the mu, you contract the vector indices, the space-time indices, and you should get this thing. Okay. So this means that some of our polarization vectors will have will have negative norm, and some of them will have positive norm. I think some people will put a minus sign to make the one component have a negative norm, and have three components have positive norm. But I'm not going to bother with that.
So the lambdas are on the same footing as the ordered indices?
Sorry?
So the lambdas, the polarization labels,
right,
are on the same footing as the ordered indices, so you can contract them with the eta. Well, it looks like they should be, the way that you introduce them, it looks like there's something different, right? But, you put them in brackets and you sample 1 over 4.
Right, so they are labels. These are labels. And you have to actually choose. You can say, okay, can I put, say, delta here? Mm-hmm. And the problem is that then you would not be able to get the most general solution to this guy, because you know that, for you to be able to write down, polarization vectors of this form, which are null, your basis space will have to have polarization vectors whose norms would have to be both positive and negative. And to ensure that, you actually have to contract with the Minkowski, quote unquote, Minkowski metric. Okay? So let's look at one example. And look at one example, and suppose take a plane wave. And your for momentum is given by this guy. So it's a plane wave that is traveling in the z direction. Then, E mu 1 or 2, we can choose those as E 1 or 2, where the non-zero components of E 1 are in the x, y direction. And the non-zero components of E2 are also in the xy direction, right? Those are two examples, the two of the polarization vectors. But we also have this guy, we can use this as a, which we can call time-like.
E1 and E2?
Sorry, E1 and E2 are. So okay, E1 and E2 are some polarization vector, which where you know the entries are non-zero in the x and y direction. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Right. So what I mean is that you know, say E1 dot k is 0. And this we call the longitudinal tensor, polarization. So before we quantize the theory, you know, let's just observe, observe that this guy, you know, this equation does not actually follow from the Maxwell Lagrangian that I wrote down. So this does not follow from this. However, if we add a term to our Lagrangian, which we call the gauge fixing term, which has this form, then you know up to discarding a total derivative part. This Lagrangian, which was first written down by Fermi, gives us this form of the equation. Right. So yeah. So we are actually not quantizing the. Technically, we're not quantizing the Maxwell theory. We are quantizing some other theory, that is given by this Lagrangian. And in this Lagrangian, we'll see that you know So okay, so this Lagrangian does contain, for example, this guy, right? This was something that we didn't have in the original Lagrangian. So we are going to quantize, you know, this theory, and then basically what we are going to do, and what we know is that you know this classical Lagrangian is basically, you know, what you would get. You know, gives you the equation of motion if you had imposed the Lorentz gauge condition. But when you quantize this Lagrangian, you'd expect that, you know, that this condition, the Lorentz gauge condition, to have some sort of quantum mechanical, you know, it would be realized at some quantum mechanical level. And we'll see that it is realized, but in a very subtle way. Okay? So in this sense, you know, for example, you know, I've seen people, you know, when they quantize this theory, they say, well, we are actually not quantizing the original theory. But these are the kind of things you have to do whenever you're trying to quantize a gauge theory. Yes, Pati.
The epsilon mu 0 and 3 that you wrote down,
right. They don't satisfy epsilon. No, they don't satisfy, but these are just the complete basis. That will solve the orthogonality and the completeness relationships. So these are the bases that you use, okay? So this modified Lagrangian means that the canonically conjugate field to A mu is given by this. So recall that in the previous case, the A0 dot was not in the, it was not in our previous Lagrangian, and therefore the pi 0 was vanishing. But in this Lagrangian, pi 0 is no longer vanishing. So we can hope to quantize things in a covariant fashion. So now we impose the usual commutation relationships. So we say, we go to some, we quantize in the Schrodinger picture. So we choose our commutation relationship to be, say, at some frozen in time, some reference time. This thing is zero. And the canonically conjugate momentum pi is minus of a dot. So we also have to impose this thing. And then the non-trivial one so I've chosen this sign in such a way that when you take the spatial parts of these guys that matches the commutation relationships that you impose for the scalar case. Because our our metric has signature plus, minus, minus, minus. So if you take this, say, to be the spatial direction, the minus sign cancels this guy. So that's basically, what I've chosen. I think that that's what's consistent with the scalar field. But notice that because of, to make the commutation relationship covariant, we had to introduce this metric tensor eta mu nu. Then the formal definition of the Feynman propagator. So the Feynman propagator we take the definition from the case of the scalar field. Well, okay. So this is the definition of the formal of the Feynman propagator, and you can show that this is actually the massless limit of the Feynman propagator of the scalar field. So this is the real scalar field, but taking the mass going to 0. And explicitly, this is the same expression as before, but now there is no mass. The mass term is missing. So these commutation relationships imply that these following commutations and all other commutations vanish. So before we, you know, break, or we leave today, I'm just going to end on a cliffhanger. And the cliffhanger is this. The consequence, one of the consequences of these commutation relationships, trying to make them covariant, is this. You know, consider the state that you would create by applying the creation operator associated to A0 on the vacuum. And it has some momentum p. So what is the norm of such a state? So we have so if you now use the commutation relation to, you know, switch these guys around, you know, the first term vanishes. The second term, which comes from the delta function, we get a minus 2 pi cubed 2 of e of p eta 0, 0. So eta 0, 0 in our case, remember, is plus 1 times delta of 0. So it turns out that if you want to quantize your theory in a way which preserves covariance, so you want to start with a Lagrangian which comes from the gauge-fixed Maxwell's equation, you have states which have quote-unquote negative norm. And this would be a disaster if this was not somehow, you know, absent from physically measurable theories. And next time, we'll see how this is actually solved. Okay. Any questions so far? Yeah?
So in this canonic commutation relation where the metric shows up or the intermetric, it's like the root of all evil, right?
Yeah.
The point is that it does, I mean, why does it show up? I don't understand this, because the canonic momentum would have the index on the other side. I mean, like if our canonic variable has it, and it goes downstairs, like a mu, then the momentum has to have it upstairs. And the canonic commutation relation is just a quantica delta, which is always upstairs.
Yeah, but, you know, that's just artificial. You're just you know, you can always lower that index. When you lower the index, you know, for that equation to be, you know, covariant under Lorentz transformation, this has to be, you know, you'll have to have, you know, eta. Sorry, what? Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with that. The Kronecker symbol is Lorentz invariant, but you know, but you are always free to lower Okay. What you're saying is this. Okay, what you're saying is that I have a mu, say a mu pi nu,
yeah.
And I'm doing delta mu nu. That's fine. That's perfectly consistent with what I've done. But now, if you lower the index on pi mu, then you would get eta mu nu. So that's exactly what I've done. Okay? Right, okay, so what you're saying is that you want to do this by kind of fiat. Right? So the left-hand side is Lorentz covariant, the right-hand side isn't. Right, eta mu nu, when they're both downstairs, is not a Lorentz invariant object, covariant object. You know that, so. But no, it's good to try different things, right? Okay?